The one where your breathing actually stops is the fourth jhana. And the way that happens is that I'm told that physiology doesn't work this way, but you do have a sense that the breath energy is coming in and out the pores. And all the breath channels in the body are so well connected that you don't have to pump it in and pump it out. There's kind of a sense of just everything is open. And it's not because you're suppressing the breath. If you need the breath, you will breathe, but you just don't need it. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fact that your oxygen, or your brain, which is the main user of oxygen in the body, is calming down quite a bit. Then you know that trigger in the mind that basically says, whoops, the carbon dioxide levels are getting high, you need to breathe. It's not being triggered. And so that's the point where your breathing stops. So third jhana, you're getting pretty close to the breathing stopped. It's very, very subtle. But there's still a subtle sense of kind of in and out. But the fourth jhana, just bang, you're there. Mm-hmm. For some people, rapture is not all that noticeable. It's just a sense of, I feel really nice where I am. It doesn't have to be a big production, no. Okay, because it's many times, if it is a big production, it's a sign that your body has been starved of breath energy and just really needs it. And so there's going to be a sense of real, you know, sort of energetic charging that comes with it. But if you're already well charged, you don't need it. Yes. Yeah, the term access concentration it comes from the commentaries. They talk about having momentary concentration, access, and then fixed penetration, the three levels. And there's some disagreement as to whether the first jhana belongs to access concentration or fixed penetration. But your mind is, I mean, you notice this as you're settling in. The mind has this process of settling down. And there are points where it's not all that secure with the breath. It's kind of there, but it's not really fixed into the breath. And that's the level where you can start drifting off easily. Especially if the breath feels really nice. And usually when the breath calms down, everything feels nice, you're associating with that the fact that you're about to fall asleep. And the mind will tend in that direction if you don't watch out for it. People who tend to have visions will tend to have visions during that period too. So what you've got to do is, when the breath starts getting comfortable, this is when you have to start spreading your awareness to fill the whole body, to keep yourself awake and work with the breath energy. There was a teacher in Thailand who had a nice way of explaining these three levels of concentration. With momentary concentration, it's like right now, you're listening to something and following it. Access concentration is deeper, and then fixed penetration. But he said basically when you're doing meditation, momentary concentration can't stand pain. Anything that's unpleasant, it's gone. You slip off, you go someplace else, you don't like the breath, bang, you're out. But with access concentration, you can withstand pain, but you can't withstand pleasure. In other words, anything painful comes up, you learn to work through it and make it more pleasant. But then when it gets pleasant, you lose focus. And with fixed penetration, pain, pleasure, you're not disturbed. And for me, that's been one of probably the most useful ways of looking at those terms. Okay, passage 15. Here again, the Buddha's talking about mindfulness shading into concentration. Okay, those who are new, not long gone forth, only recently come to this Dhamma and Vinaya. Dhamma and Vinaya, by the way, is the Buddha's own name for his teaching. He never said, I'm teaching Buddhism. He says, I'm teaching this Dhamma and Vinaya. Okay. Vinaya is the term for the discipline. Dhamma is the term for the truth. They should be roused, encouraged, and exhorted by you to develop the four establishments of mindfulness in this way. Come, friends, remain focused on the body in and of itself, being ardent, alert, with your minds unified, clear, concentrated, and single-minded for the knowledge of the body as it has come to be. So again, he's using the terminology of mindfulness and concentration there in the same sentence. It's all meant to slide together. Even those who are learners, in other words, those who've attained the first noble attainment, who have yet to attain their heart's desire, who stay resolved on the unsurpassed security and bondage, even they remain focused on the body in and of itself, being ardent, alert, one-pointed, their concentration has gotten better, with their minds unified, clear, concentrated, and single-minded for complete comprehension of the body, and then for each of the mental qualities. Even those who are arahants, whose mental fermentations are ended, who have reached fulfillment, done the task, laid down the burden, attained the true goal, totally destroyed the fetter of becoming, and who are released through right gnosis, even they remain focused on the body and of itself, being ardent, alert, one-pointed, their minds unified, clear, concentrated, and single-minded, disjoined from the body. This is a theme you see throughout the canon, is that arahants still experience the senses, but they have a sense of being disjoined. It's like they don't, because they're not out there trying to eat things, there's nothing going to come in to eat them, you know. There's a sense of being separated. One of the analogies they give in the canon, it's not a pretty analogy, but once you've heard it, it's hard to forget. You want to hear it? It's like a cow that's been butchered, and you take a knife and you cut through all the little things that connect the skin to the cow, all the connective tissues and everything, and then once you've totally cut it off, then you put the skin back on. Now the question is the skin connected as it was before? And the answer is no. I mean, even though they're in contact again, there's none of the connections. And the connections stand for craving, desire, and all the other things that can create problems at the senses. So it's this sense of being disjoined from it, even though there is contact. And so for the arahants, they're with the body, but there's a sense of being disjoined from the body, the same with feelings, etc. Now, this is not alienation or anything psychologically unhealthy. They've gotten to the point where they're not feeding on these things anymore, and one of the lessons of the feeding analogy is that the things that you feed on end up feeding on you, right? In this case, you're not feeding on them. They're not going to come feeding on you. Both sides can live in peace. Okay. So again, there's nothing more that they have to do, but this is their preferred place of keep their awareness with these four frames of reference. Okay, passage 16 we've already done. This is the cook. Oof. Passage 17 is going to require a lot of explanation, and we've got 5 minutes. So, anybody got some good 5-minute questions? Yes. Yeah, that's an old habit. It's an old habit. Subduing is actually the more accurate translation. And for a while, I switched over to putting aside, and then more recently, I switched back to subduing. And force of habit. It's closer to subduing. The word there is vinaya, which was related to discipline. You're disciplining your greed and distress. Now, sometimes you discipline people by sending them outside the room, and some other times you discipline them by forcing them down. So I guess either one would apply. Hiding out.
Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you might be feeling very pleasant or joyful, but not noticing that it's actually restlessness.
I'd say stay with the stillness and get to know it really well. There is a habit we have in the West, okay, I've got this, what's next? Without having, you know, and it must be a good cooking analogy. you've done this stage of this dish, but you haven't really fully done it, and you want to go on to the next stage. You know, you're doing your creme brulee, but you haven't really mixed the eggs with the sugar yet properly. That kind of thing. So there's certain things that you, and you're not going to really see what's going on in your concentration until you're very familiar with it. And the best way to get familiar is just keep doing it again and again and again. And deciding, okay, is today's better than yesterday's? If so, how? Or is it worse? Now there's one way in which today's is always better than yesterday's. There was a man who used to sell Chinese dumplings in front of the monastery. He'd drive by in a truck, and you know, as modern as it used to be, people would have carts, but then they got trucks to drive around, and they put loudspeakers on them, and they would announce, you know, that we're selling this, selling that, and a lot of things were fairly common, like salt, we have salt, water jars. Those weren't too special, but what was special was the Chinese dumplings guy. And I swear, he'd drive by every day around 4 o'clock, and he'd probably had a little something to drink. And he was getting a little loquacious. And one of his favorite phrases was, "Today's dumplings are better than yesterday's." And for a while I was contemplating, I mean, when is he going to hit the Platonic ideal? I mean, the ultimate dumpling. And then somebody pointed out to me, says, well, where are yesterday's dumplings right now? Today's dumplings are better, you know. So if you're sitting through a really bad meditation, you remind yourself, today's meditation is better than yesterday's. In that sense. In the other sense, you can actually get a sense, okay, today I'm still, I feel quiet. And once you've been there for a while, it's like, hey, is this good enough, or could there be something better? And the restlessness there would be, okay, when you're not ready to analyze it yet, and we'll get into that later when we start talking about how to use concentration to develop discernment. But you know, you can start analyzing it, and you've lost it, which means you're not ready for it. So you go back. Yes. When you're in the fourth jhana, you don't need to breathe. That's because the breath energy is kind of suffusing the body from all directions. And also your brain is using a lot less oxygen. I mean, I really don't know the physiology here. I just know what it feels like. And that there's a sense there's no need to breathe. It's not like you're suppressing anything. It's just the breath energy in the body is full, and it's all connected. And you just sit there. It feels really nice. I settled an argument between a couple I knew where the wife had very strong powers of concentration, and she would tell her husband, you know, I'm not breathing when I'm in this state. He said, that's impossible. It can't be true. And it actually became a source of friction in the family. This is one argument that got started over jhana. And, you know, I confirmed that, yes, it does happen. And so that calmed things down. Question in the back.
How long could you remain?
Quite long, actually. I mean, as long as the mind really is that still, you're not using up oxygen.
Like a week or something.
A day. Okay, well, one, you actually, to get good at it, you do have to get fairly attached to it. The dangerous ones, there are states of concentration which you're actually blocking out part of your body. You can have a very intense one-pointed focus. And the danger of that is that a lot of stuff going in your mind just gets pushed out. And so that's not a good foundation for alertness or for mindfulness or anything at all. The purpose of getting the mind still like this is you see things a lot more clearly. And you're getting this all-around awareness. So that things that used to come in from behind are not behind. You've got basically eyes in the back of your head now. So that, you know, things that would sneak into your mind that you wouldn't notice before, you now are beginning to notice. That's the purpose. And we'll be getting into this tomorrow about how, one, in order to develop jhana, you have to develop a certain insight into your mind, how it works. Because this is a fabricated state, and like cooking a souffle, you have to know something about the eggs, and you have to know something about heat, and all these other things to get it to happen just right. But then once you've got it there, this is where the souffle image deflates. You're in a much better position to see things, what's coming up after that. And you can catch it at earlier and earlier stages. That's why we do it. Mm-hmm. Well, it's partly the equanimity and partly the ability to ferret out at these things that used to glom together. These are separate things.
That's the discernment.
That's the discernment part.
So that's where you're developing discernment.
Right. And when you see that there's... Seeing it, well, if you really see it, just let go and say, I don't want this anymore. But it's not, you're letting go not out of aversion, but it's more like you've kind of grown up. And then equanimity will follow on that.
That's the result.
One of the results. Mm-hmm.